Hi and welcome to Matrix Moments. This is Saloni and joining us in today's episode is Prakash Sangam, the CEO of Redbus, a leading global online bus ticketing platform. This episode will be moderated by Tarun Davla, Managing Director at Matrix Partners India. Today's discussion is focused on the mobility sector and more specifically on the bus ticketing ecosystem. We talk about the COVID recovery patterns and change in consumer behavior. Learnings from Redbus's journey, especially their journey in international markets, and lastly, takeaways from Prakash's personal experience as a leader of one of the largest bus ticketing platforms of the world. Tune in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Matrix Moments. We have a very special guest with us on this episode today. For those of you listening in, we have Prakash from Redbus. Prakash is the CEO of Redbus and has previously spent time at both Unilever and Info Edge. Prakash, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
So Prakash, I'm going to just dive in directly with my first question. And this is something that a lot of people have a top of mind question. Obviously, everybody is sitting at home. All of us are wondering, you know, when the current state of affairs will change and all of us will hopefully get back to some version of our previous lives. And, you know, as I was thinking about, you know, Redbus, in some ways, it's an index of sort of mobility and travel within our country, right? At least for what Real India represents. And so I thought the first question, which would be interesting for, you know, people to hear about is how are you seeing early COVID recovery patterns? And maybe also talk a little bit about any change in consumer behavior that you're noticing.
Sure, Tarun. So, you know, we are part of Make My Trip Group, which is a publicly listed company. So I won't be divulging exact numbers because as we speak, we have got our results announcement scheduled for later this week. And that is for Q1. But we are already the bang in the middle of Q2. But talking about trends, I think the recovery has been admittedly a bit slow. If you had asked me this question about 4 weeks back, I would have said that, look, things are looking a bit dire. But we have seen, use a very cliche term, there are definitely green shoots now. There has been a clear recovery in demand and in transactions and daily travel that we're witnessing over the last 3 weeks or so. Yeah. One of the fundamental reasons why the recovery has been slow is because, you know, there are three large states, two of them are quite large, Maharashtra and TN and Kerala. These three states accounted for about 42% of our pre-COVID numbers. Right. And these three states have not yet resumed any kind of travel. So there is no interstate travel or even within state travel happening there. So as a result, you know, this 42% is practically zero. Right.
Yeah.
And the other other states have indeed allowed travel to happen. There are some states that don't allow interstate travel. Right. And but then, you know, a lot of interstate travel happens. It cuts through boundaries of multiple states. So if one state in the middle is not allowing free movement of, transportation vehicles, then that causes a hindrance. And so the number of operational routes are lower. There have been a whole bunch of, you know, unlock guidelines that have been put out by the central government. And while most of them do call for unhindered movement of both goods and people, again, different states have chosen to tighten those regulations. So you would be aware, as many people listening to it would be too, that the quarantine rules are different in different states. Different states have different requirements in terms of taking pre-approval for travel. So all of that is also causing uncertainty and hence, you know, demand is further suppressed. Having said that, over the last 2-3 weeks, very clearly we are seeing a reversal of the trend. Things are picking up, traffic has come back, conversion rates are improving. We are seeing travel happening now. It, in a way, coincided with a couple of festivals that happened, Raksha Bandhan and Eid happened close to each other. I think that triggered it. But if I look at the route composition and if I were to understand what is happening and derive some numbers from there, a lot of it is happening because of migration. Migration has now come back. We were in the initial part of COVID talking about reverse migration. But now we are seeing migration again. So a lot of the movement that we are seeing is from tier 3 towns coming to tier 1 metro towns. And that is what is driving the demand right now. And that is good news because, you know, that indicates that economic activity is going to pick up. And I think the economic engine is all interconnected, right? So one part of the economy starts, if economy were to recover, I think there are cascading effects and, you know, different parts, you know, start firing at different times. But the good part is that there is movement happening, right? And once this were to happen, then over time, it is good for all sectors, including ours. The other thing, which is very anecdotal, very early days yet, but if you look at the number of daily active cases over the last two, three days, since August 1st, the growth rate of active cases has dramatically declined. And from 15th and 16th August were two consecutive days where, you know, it went negative for the first time, negative growth, as in absolute numbers had reduced. That also gives some confidence that, you know, if you are able to get a hold on the spread of the virus, that should lead to greater confidence in traveling, right? You also asked about what has been some of the consumer behavior changes. And so we do see changes in both preferences as well as business mix very clearly. One kind of significant shift has been that if you take the top 7-8 metros, right? And if you just were to look at travel happening between these metros, they contributed to about, you know, about 10% of sales for us pre-COVID. Okay, the travel between these metros, the large metros, the 7-8 large metros. And given that these are the most impacted by COVID, that number is down to about 1.5%. So that is where the demand has been hit.
Wow.
Now, if you further expand it to add about 41 cities, which are, you know, more than a million plus in the country, and if you were to look at travel happening within these cities, right? It was 25% pre-COVID was happening between these cities, and 75% used to be traveled to or from the smaller towns. So 25-75, that has become now 10-90. So 90% of travel is actually now originating or terminating in smaller towns.
Smaller towns.
Yeah, so that is a just a mixed change. As a result of it, what we have also seen happening is that there is very clearly the percentage of transactions that come to us from new customers on our platform, that has nearly doubled, which means that a lot of those customers who were earlier probably more comfortable just booking offline, there seems to be a greater tendency towards making booking online. And even the supply side, like we have seen with, especially with large, you know, road transport corporations in the country, which hold a large amount of inventory, only a fraction of that was initially available for booking, for online booking. So to give you an example of APSRTC, we had about 70,000-80,000 seats being available on a daily basis for booking online. But the number of people who travel on APSRTC buses on a daily basis pre-COVID was about 60 lakhs, right? So it's a, so a lot of that inventory is actually offline, right? But now not all of it has not come online, but a significant, so everybody is now pushing towards getting a lot of the inventory which was available, not available online, to bring them online, because nobody wants, you know, a crowding up of, you know, bus terminals or queuing happening there. Everybody is looking for online ticketing, contactless. So we are seeing that the inventory addition also is going up on the supply side. So these are some really good signs. On the migration routes that I talked about, you know, buses originating from towns like Azamgarh, Varanasi, Gorakhpur, Muzaffarnagar, Patna, all of them going to Delhi, the occupancy is nearly 100% there, very clearly. There is very clearly, people are making one-time travel. So there's a one-way travel has gone up. So if you were to look at pre-COVID, 30% of our bookings or transactions were return trips. Now that 30 has become 20, so one way has gone up. So these are some of the kind of changes that we have seen in terms of, you know, consumer behavior. The sensitivity towards safety has gone up for sure. People, the kind of reviews and ratings that we get on the platform, we are starting to see many more comments about people, you know, commenting on the safety aspects of a bus. So these things are the ones that have changed.
That's fascinating. I have actually two follow-up questions, and this was really insightful. Thank you, Prakash. Two questions. You mentioned about how people are focused much more on safety, right? Just talk a little bit about, on the actual supply side, given that you run a marketplace model, on the supply side, how have your suppliers adapted to this in terms of, you know, change in configuration, change in the way the route is run, etc. And also talk a little bit about, it's been a it's been a very difficult time from a financial sort of perspective, because you know, while you're a marketplace, each of these, you know, actual operators, how have they navigated this?
Yeah, good question. So if you look at on the safety aspect, I think every bus operator I've spoken to, right? And no matter from which part of the country, it need not be from just the larger towns, even from some of the kind of mid-tier towns like say Jaipur or Coimbatore. Yeah. I think the sensitivity towards taking care of safety has been very, very high. Everyone wants to ensure that they put their best foot forward. There was a feeling, yeah, at least now it is spread so much that it is very difficult to figure out from where people have caught the infection now. Right? It's just it's almost like community transmission. But in the early days, you know, operators were very sure that they didn't want to be associated, didn't want it to be mentioned that, you know, somebody traveled on this bus and that is where they got the infection, or somebody who was already infected had traveled on this bus, etc. So people were very, very conscious, and they continue to be, right? So in terms of the guidelines to be followed, there has been some fairly detailed guidelines that have come out in many states around how to treat and sanitize buses. And we have also done a lot of work in terms of, you know, equipping bus operators with information with respect to sanitization and deep cleaning, especially cleaning up the high contact surfaces like handles, armrests, you know, luggage racks and stuff like that. As far as social distancing is concerned, people have gone by what different state governments have regulated. So in South, there has been a clear mandate of a 50% kind of social distancing. So given that in this market, a lot of the inventory hosting is also done on our platforms, we had to quickly gear up. So we had, you know, kind of a static social distancing where, you know, every alternate seat is blocked, and also dynamic. In dynamic, you allow people who are from the same family to book seats next to each other. But if a single person were to book, then the seat next to that would get automatically.
So
that people can travel with themselves. At the same time, operators have a slightly higher chance of getting more occupancy, right?
Do the economics work for them? Like if I were to follow this 50% social distancing, like does the route of economics actually make sense for these operators?
Look, the prices have indeed gone up. So wherever the occupancy has been kind of, you know, artificially been reduced to say 50%, there the prices have gone up by nearly... It's not doubled, but it has gone up by 150-160% in all those routes. But the larger, you know, the impact on is, you know, overall occupancy. So at 150-160%, it's okay if I'm able to get... fill up 50% of the bus, right? But if I'm not able to do that, then that becomes a challenge.
Yeah, then that's an issue. Yeah. Got it.
And then, you know, ensuring that, you know, the crew is sensitized. Look, bus travel has some advantages, you know, intrinsic advantages, right? First, it's a mode in which there are fewer people traveling, as opposed to a train or a flight where there are many more people inside an enclosed space. Here, there are far fewer. Two, if you find that somebody has got symptoms, even along the way, you can, you know, stop and, you know, offboard that passenger at the most convenient place, etc.
Yeah.
So sensitivity of that crew in terms of ensuring that they are not ill, they are being scanned with the, you know, for the temperature, ensuring that passengers are scanned. All of these things ensure that luggages are sanitized before they're loaded in the compartment. All of that has been done by people, and people have been quite... what we have done as a marketplace to ensure that people follow these rules is that we have put like a 3-point checks. So the first point check is, you know, by our own supply teams, kind of, you know, working with operators to ensure that there is that people are sufficiently equipped, they've got the right information, that they're following these processes. Second, we have tied up with a third party audit firm, which goes and audits bus operators for their processes to ensure that, do they have the, like, for example, are they maintaining a log of the crew's temperatures? So they would know, you can't fake it. It's either there or not there. Do they have the sufficient cleaning material in their godowns to ensure that the buses are being sanitized? And then they also do operational checks to ensure that when the boarding is happening, is there, you know, adequate social distancing being maintained when people are boarded, whether a scan of passengers are happening. This audit report, we get a very comprehensive audit report along with pictures, etc. right? Some of that along with the certificate that is given to the operator. There's a validity of this process before we repeat it. And the third check that we have built in is basically from user-generated content itself. So we have roped in our frequent travelers, people who have done more than one transaction. We send them a notification asking them that would they be okay to audit the bus on which they are traveling. They participate. And it's just a checkbox. It's very visual. So they check it up. And if they find something is not as per what is mentioned, then they encourage them to take pictures and submit it to us so that we have got proof and evidence, and we go and talk to our bus operators about it. And we incentivize them with some amount of money into the Red Bus wallet. So this is a third level of check. So we are ensuring that one, things are available. One, information is available. Mm. They've got the processes in place that is audited, and an ongoing check being done through the by the passengers themselves.
Excellent. That's actually really, really interesting. You know, the other topic I wanted to touch upon is, I think you mentioned about online inventory going up as a result of this, right? And we're obviously hearing this across multiple sectors, where if you look out, maybe in the short term, you know, things aren't looking as good. But if I were to look out, you know, 6 months, 12 months, and hopefully when all this is behind us, overall digital adoption is on a massive sort of upswing. Is that your forecast as well for this, for your segment?
Yeah, Tarun. So, like I told you, right, the percentage of daily transactions which are conducted by new users has doubled for us. Now, in the past, I mean, for us as a market leader, the only way that we will grow is by, there is very little opportunity as far as share gain from other online players is concerned. We are going to grow by making people move away from the more traditional methods of booking to come online, right?
Yes.
And we have done multiple campaigns over the past many years, different kinds of, you know, activities. Nowhere have we seen this kind of blip, right? Our new user percentages have not doubled like the way it is happening now. And while, you know, other travel comes up, I think this is the delta that we will see. And I think once people start adopting online, the sheer convenience of it, right, will make them keep coming back, right? So I think I have no doubts that this delta is going to be there with us, and we will reap the benefits of this going forward too. And just before I conclude, you had asked me another question earlier, which was about while we are a marketplace, our suppliers are holding inventory.
Yes.
How are they managing during this tough time?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think it's been brutal, to put it mildly. And so some things have helped. So for example, this whole EMI moratorium has really helped because look at it for a bus operator, he has two or three big cost elements. One is the people cost, the staff cost. Second is the cost of his infrastructure, which is the vehicles that he owns. So this EMI moratorium has really helped because that is made sure that they are not having a cash outflow when they don't have an inflow. As far as people cost and staff and salary cost is concerned, depending on the capacity of operators, you know, there has been a slew of things that have happened. I think the larger operators have still managed to keep their staff at some levels of salary cuts, etc. But some of the medium terms ones, people who didn't have enough resources, they have lost the staff. The staff has migrated back to where they came from, and so that is what it is. When it comes to revival, right? I think there are some states which have announced some good policies, like making sure that the road taxes that have been paid can be deferred, or in some cases they're being off. So those kind of things will also help. But it's been tough. I think. Bus operators are just waiting right now. Everybody has kind of, you know, down their shutters wherever things are not opened up, and really conserving capital, conserving cash. And I think once things open up, we will see people coming in, reopening, I'm sure. And while there will be some people who will move out, I also see other people from other people coming in. because the entire ecosystem is very SME focused. It's very SMEs and MSMEs, right? So we do see typically a big churn in this segment. So we do have operators coming in and going out that will possibly get accelerated.
Okay, that's great, Prakash. I'm actually going to segue into another question, and then I want to get into the international journey as well after that. One last topic on COVID and sort of, you know, managing through this crisis for y'all. Talk a little bit about, you know, obviously Redbus has been known as a great place to work. I know y'all have won several awards in that respect as well. As a leader, you know, managing the organization through this crisis, I'm sure it's not been an easy task, right? Can you talk a little bit about, A, just overall from org building perspective, what principles do y'all follow? And through this crisis, any specific things that you'll have done to kind of make sure that the team is motivated? Because, you know, overall travel, it's all about been about gloom and doom, right? Oh, this isn't coming back. Oh, 1 year, the industry is, you know, kind of lost out and stuff like that, right? Talk a little bit about as a leader, what do you do to kind of keep the organization motivated through this phase?
Look, I think, yes, it has been tough for everyone. But, you know, just to reemphasize that point, it is, I think everyone has seen that in this case, when it came to this crisis, right? The impact of it is far more broad-based than anything else, right? I mean, you had the past crisis in 2008, and perhaps that impacted the banking sector a lot more. I mean, consumer goods companies did not get impacted. Consumer demand did not get impacted to that extent. It was probably... Yes. Some sectors like banking and some export-oriented sectors, etc. Right, but in this case, I think people have all seen that this is far more broad-based,
much more broad-based,
and people are mature enough to realize that this is something that is a perhaps a once-in-a-lifetime event, and it's impacted everyone. So. From our side specifically, I think it basically boils down to two things. One is that what did we do today or in the when this crisis hit? And second, what have we done in the past, right?
It's all also the equity you built up with the team. Yeah,
exactly, right? So what we have done today is in terms of, you know, just communication. So one thing is that we got this trend early in a sense that this is going to be, the impact of this on travel is going to be pretty extreme. And we moved pretty early, not just at Redbus, but even at a group level, wherein we convened as early as, you know, towards the middle part of March itself to think through, you know, what is going to happen and what is going to be the impact and thereby what are the steps that we need to take, right?
Yeah.
So we were able to take cost-cutting measures far earlier than many other companies did so. And one of that was also about you know pay cuts for employees, we communicated that quite early. We told people what is the rationale for it, and as I said, people all understood the reasons why we are doing it. And through the crisis, what we have done is to just because especially when people working from home as well, it is not that you have an opportunity to connect with people on the floor,
yes,
formally or informally. So we upped our communication intensity and frequency. So usually we would have a quarterly town hall. We would have one quarterly all hands meet where we would talk about the previous quarter and talk about what we are doing going forward and take Q&A from people. Here we were in the initial part, we started doing it every month. Then we got feedback in one of our such Zoom all hands saying that, you know, we should be doing this more often. We appreciate this, but we should be communicating even more often. So then we doubled the frequency. We got different formats to have communication going in from people. And it was just not me talking, it was the entire leadership team who got involved as well. And we had different ways, different formats in which we were communicating with people and talking them through and keeping them informed, right? About what is happening, what are some of the trends. We got some lift because we started seeing that some of the international markets started doing, came back much faster. right? So that perked up people's mood. So all this was widely shared. So everybody understood. So it was really about communication. But I think, this I'm pretty sure everybody would have done. I'm sure all leaders would have done. But really, to my mind, it is about some of these hard decisions. People take it based on the investment that has been made earlier, right? What kind of culture has been created? And I think, credit to the team. We are a very, it's been a very different journey for us at Redbus, right? I mean, it's a young organization, but it's the founding team had moved out 7 years ago. So I always tell the team that, look, it is not we are still as young an organization as many organizations out there, but we don't have a founder or a owner, etc. now. So it is something that we collectively own, right? So there is collective ownership. And I think that more than anything is the glue that binds everyone together. So we have had the strong bonds that exist because of this. It's almost, there is a classic, how do you, I've tried to understand culture a little bit because it's so soft word, right? But there are some hard papers on, how do you measure culture, etc. And there's a 2x2, classic 2x2. And we had done this exercise once, and the top right-hand corner is something called a clan kind of a culture, where you are, and so we kind of fall there. So it's almost like,
that. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we are some, so not that one is better than the other. I'm just saying that box is what the kind of culture that we fall into. So it's a bit of, I have your back kind of attitude. It's supportive. The other part is, if you look at the team that works with me, everybody has been on the organization for, for good part of, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. Even one level below. So people have been around for a while. So there have been a lot of people with age in the system. So all of that has built a lot of trust and credibility. And I think that has stood us in good stead during this tough time.
Excellent. I'm going to just segue into another topic that I think you touched upon, which is around your international journey, right? I don't know if too many people know, but obviously y'all are in multiple markets other than just India. I think most people still think of Redbus as a, India only company, but you guys were one of the first few people to actually go outside India and have done a great job at it, right? So can you talk a little bit about, just again, for the founders on this call, several of them think about expanding outside India market, right? If you can maybe just touch upon a little bit about, in your mind, when's the right time for a founder to think about going outside India? If they were to choose to do that, any learnings from your experience on identifying the market, any learnings from talking about how did you all analyze and research customer behavior in these markets? Because India, right, you've been living here, everybody has enough, understanding of what the market is, but how do you all do customer, research in these countries before your launch? What kind of product changes did those influence, and how did that change how you operate Redbus India versus Redbus in some of these other countries? And any learnings, anything that you can share that you think would be helpful for sort of founders as they are thinking through their decision?
Look, I think whether somebody should think about international expansion or not, it is really a decision about capital allocation, right? And if people feel that the opportunity for capital to generate more returns continues to be in India, then obviously, it's time to just double down here before expanding, right? For us, there were two, three considerations. One is that our core India bus business did not require too much of capital. I mean, even when we started thinking about going out, it was, we didn't need too much of capital for the India bus business. And of course, pre-COVID, it was a cash generating business. So it was also then about deploying that capital as well. So for us, the options were, so what more do we do in India apart from our core bus business? What are the other opportunities that we can look to tap versus taking our current business model and going to international market? So those were the choices. It was not about saying that, can I do more with my bus business? Because that business was generating was not needing
Correct.
Capital earlier and was generating capital or generating cash going for later time, right? So we said that. So we said we will, and we were getting a lot of inbound inquiries as well, because if you look at Redbus, it's a kind of a pioneering company in this space. So when it yes. came to a lot of the other emerging markets, any startup who would look to do something in the road transportation, intercity space would look at Redbus as an example.
Would look at,
yeah. Yes. And we would get a lot of inbound interest from people asking for advice, asking for licensing our tech, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So we had this in mind.
Yeah.
And our earlier investor, when we started on this journey, was Naspers. I mean, they were our primary shareholders. And Naspers, you know, model also is to take some assets and then take it around the globe.
Replicate so it
all,
up, yeah.
Yeah, so it all kind of gelled in. And and when we look to do it, we essentially had like four filtering criteria when we looked at market attractiveness. The first thing was return on effort, right? We figured that it is as tough to open out operations in, say, Sri Lanka as it is in Indonesia. I mean, you have to go and set up a legal entity. There are some local, you know, legal hurdles that you have to overcome. You have to open a bank account. You have to appoint people locally. You have to manage statutory compliances, multiple things.
Yes.
Right? So it makes sense to put in an effort where the absolute size of the market is high, right? So given a choice, I would rather enter markets which are large, which are big sized markets, rather than entering small sized markets, because the amount of effort is the same, right? So we didn't enter into, you know, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Nepal, and all. Although we had like we knew people there, etc. Because we said that look, it's going to take effort. Let's identify the bigger markets to go after. The second one that we looked at was, you know, we are a two-sided marketplace, a classic two-sided marketplace. And two-sided marketplaces work when there is enough supply fragmentation.
Supply.
So we said we need to look at markets where there is supply fragmentation. So if you look at a market like Mexico, it's a huge intercity bus market, bigger than India, much bigger. But we didn't enter Mexico because the supply was very, very consolidated. It was concentrated in the hands of a few players who dominated various parts of the country, and you couldn't operate without them, and they wouldn't want to work with you, etc., etc. So a lot of problems there. The third criteria that we had was, you know, what is the e-commerce evolution of that country? Because ultimately, when you're building out a category, and if you look at the India internet story as well, right? I mean, a lot of things happened simultaneously from 2014, correct, 2015 onwards, when the big bucks started flowing into the India internet space.
Yes.
Because everybody works with each other. If Amazon is driving penetration, it impacts a lot of other companies. If
everybody
is driving something, so it's a
No, with payments, with logistics, I mean, you need that infrastructure to
infrastructure to happen, and it benefits everyone. So we said e-commerce penetration, right, in terms of e-commerce evolution of the economy, and how many people have like good payments infrastructure, how many of them are transacting online. Those become, you know, very important, because if you can be very early otherwise in the country, and then spend a lot of time just burning and not growing because, you know, the market is not developed enough, right? So there's no point being too early into a market as well. So Nigeria is a classic example of that, where Nigeria, large population, you know, low per capita income, a lot of dependence on bus as a transport medium. But like in India, we are scared of Nigerian fraudsters. So just imagine what the situation is in Nigeria. People are like, nobody transacts online because the amount of frauds are very, very high. So the e-commerce evolution in Nigeria is very poor. The last one was, you know, regulations. How friendly are the regulations of the country? Because when we go into that market, we are FDI into that country. So what are the, how friendly are they for FDI, etc.? So that is the fourth kind of filter that we kept in mind. And then we narrowed down countries, and that is how we looked at it to enter. In terms of
just out of curiosity, which would be the top three markets? I mean, assuming the regulations and all weren't a constraint, which would be the top three markets outside India for bus travel?
So Brazil, Mexico, Indonesia, Turkey, Vietnam.
Interesting.
Yeah, and if you were to not consider e-commerce, even Nigeria is a big market.
Is a big market. And which ones of these are you all sort of currently in now?
So we are in Malaysia, Singapore, which is one market. We are in Indonesia, And we are in Peru and Colombia, because even they are large markets, small population, but you know, very few airports, because this is Andes, mountainous country.
Yes.
Very few airports and no railway, right? So bus travel is...
Oh, so bus is a big travel thing.
Okay. Yeah, it's close to... Between the two put together, they are equivalent to the India bus market size in terms of the overall market size.
Interesting.
Yeah, so we are in these markets. And to answer your question about, you know, how do we get to know and get to understand the market before we enter, right? Mm-hmm. To my mind, a two-day intense trip into any of these countries is the best way to learn about it. I have figured out contacts. Like I said, we used to get a lot of inbound. So, we used to reach out through LinkedIn to other internet company founders in those markets and tell them that, hey, we are going to be traveling. Would it be okay to meet up with us? Like Naspers was an investor, so they had connects in some of these countries, so they would connect up us to people, right? So look at contacts that your you know, investors may have. You can reach out to people on LinkedIn to, you know, sense check the market, but then travel there, understand it, figure things out. A two-day trip is good enough to meet some suppliers. You know, just in a place like Brazil, we had appointed a formal market research company like AC Nielsen to do some work for us, but that is typically an expensive affair. The best way to get, you know, real conviction is to
just firsthand,
quick. Even a and earlier I used to think it'll take like 3-5 days, but I figured that even a 2-day intense visit where you just you know, do back-to-back meetings and you line that up before you go there gives a very good perspective about the market and about the opportunity.
Very interesting
players, all of that. And in terms of the product, it's quite funny because when we, so it more came out as a bet saying that, you know, in one of our conferences, quarterly reviews or something, we said, okay, what will it take to launch our first international market next quarter? Okay.
Mm.
So we just took this up as a challenge and said, okay, let's do this. And and a couple of people then traveled to, we went to Singapore because we already had a existing, our holding company was, you know, had a entity in Singapore. So we could just start off from there, opening up a bank account just took one day. So we had, and we knew bus operators, buses go from Singapore to Malaysia. It's actually failed the test of big market, but it is so accessible. And as a POC, it was so quick to do that. Somebody just landed up there, spoke to a couple of operators. They were interested to sign up. They said, okay. And then we just took a instance of the of our India site, put that up, hosted separately, just made some changes, and just launched it in Singapore. And we started seeing some, after about 7-8 days, we started seeing some transactions as well. We did some basic SEM, SEO. So that gave us a quick sense that, you know, it can work. I mean, and seeing it in front of your eyes gives you some more confidence and comfort that this is possible to do, right?
Absolutely.
So parallelly, we had started off on the work of, you know, so till that point in time, like any startup, we were very monolithic in our architecture because we had built it up, you know, as and when the market requirements came in, as and when we thought of feature additions, it was built on the same code base. And we couldn't have expanded internationally with that kind of an architecture. So our tech team then focused on converting that monolithic code base into more microservices-based, more modular microservices-based architecture.
Yeah.
So that really helped us then to be able to then support multiple, apart from this, the way we built it out, it could support multiple time zones, it could support multiple currencies, it could support multiple languages too, right? And because it's modularized, we are able to quickly, you know, kind of take into account if there are some nuances which are different in a particular country, right?
Yeah.
And quickly adapt it just in that module and make changes in that module to suit a particular requirement of a particular country without it impacting what is happening in India. And there are various such things. For example, the first country that we launched, Singapore, Malaysia, we realized that people actually search from bus terminal to bus terminal. They would search from, say, Little India in Singapore to TBS terminal in Kuala Lumpur. They wouldn't say, many of them would not do a Singapore to Kuala Lumpur, but that was alien in India because there are no bus terminals. People do Bangalore, Chennai, right?
Yeah.
So that was a, so we needed to, you know, take into account that. in a country like Malaysia, Indonesia, online payments are poor, so people would have to make offline payments. They would have to go and consummate the transaction either in an Alphamart or an Indomaret store, or they would have to go to an ATM to conclude the transaction. So to support offline payments, the amount of time that you block the seat, in India, we block a seat only for 10 minutes. Here, you have to block the seat for 45 minutes because you have to give him time to go out of his house, go to an ATM, do the transaction and come back. So these are some nuances and changes that you see, which can be easily incorporated once you have a more modular architecture. Then you make the changes depending on what a country wants. Some features which are very early for a country then can be turned off. You don't have to have them.
Yes.
So that is the kind of work that that we did on the international side on the product to be able to launch
it.
Excellent.
This is very good. I think we are almost out of time, but I think it would be remiss on my part to not ask you two questions, which I know have been top of mind for some people as I spoke to them about this podcast. And we can keep it quick, right? So one is, any memorable incident or any early experience from your childhood days or younger days that have helped shape you into, you know, who you are today? Anything that you can think of or share with the audience?
Yeah, look, some of my core thinking has come by reading books. So two of the earliest books that influenced my thought process as I got into adult life.
Yeah.
And I don't even know how I learned on these books. It's just serendipity. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
One was, you know, this writings by Ayn Rand, Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and all that. So that is my built by some foundational beliefs around the power of rational thinking, why capitalism is a better kind of a system,
Model.
Right?
Yeah.
Those things have stayed with me all this while. So a lot of my approach or thinking is based on those books. And the other one in terms of, you know, what I did for my career and what influenced me, and this is specifically when I say I don't even know how I chanced upon that book, is a autobiography by a gentleman called Lee Iacocca. He was the president of Ford Motor Company, and then he went on to become the chairman of Chrysler. And Chrysler was in bankruptcy, and he nursed it back to health.
Yeah.
He got a bailout from the federal government, etc. It's a story about him. I mean, there are so many figures in modern business, right? I don't know what is about Lee Iacocca, but somehow I chanced on that book. And I must say,
I've read that one as well. It's a fascinating read. I had read that when I was in school as well. So.
Yeah, read and reread it so many times, and that developed a fascination for business and marketing and all of that. So yeah, I think these books have been quite influential in terms of, you know, making me the person I am.
Excellent. Okay, and last question before we conclude. I think you're one of the fortunate people to have worked with, you know, someone we all consider a legend when it comes to Indian internet, right? Mr. Sanjeev Bikhchandani. Can you narrate any one incident that, or any one leadership trait that you would have picked up from him having seen him operate?
Yeah, I think, so one is I should definitely talk about my first meeting with Sanjeev. It was quite hilarious. So I was in Airtel then. I had joined Airtel from FMCG thinking, wanting to do, you know, learn about value-added services on the mobile, etc. And I quickly realized that, look, all the innovation and excitement is on the internet side. Mobile is going to be just the carrier of the internet.
The pipe.
The pipe. And then internet is where all the action is going to be. And I was fortunate to be introduced to Sanjeev, and then I met Sanjeev was gracious enough to give me a meeting, and I thought I'll just go there and take some advice on career. And within like 10 minutes of that conversation, Sanjeev calls Ambarish, who was the CFO then of Info Edge.
Yeah, I remember you telling me this, but yeah, please share it with the audience.
And then the HR head came in, Sharmeen, and I was wondering what is happening here, because I had gone to just meet Sanjeev for some career advice, and why are all these people in the room? And Hitesh would want to be my boss. Later on, was traveling that day; he wasn't there. And then it all just ended. And the next day, Sanjeev called and said, look, we really liked you and I want you to, you know, why don't you come and join Naukri as a product head? I was like, I was like absolutely, I don't know what emotions. I felt thoroughly unprepared because I had gone to Airtel to learn from having done FMCG, how things worked. And I had no clue, frankly. So I told Sanjeev that, look, Sanjeev, I don't think I'll be able to do a good job with this. I'm not confident. I will let this pass. And I think that was there. But then 2 months later, he called again. And he remembered a nugget of our conversation where I told him something about education. And I had mentioned to him that how one of the things I'd seen in Airtel was how people consumed educational content
on you.
Especially learning to speak English and all that. Right? This was very early days of value-added services.
This is not the VAS days.
VAS days and all. So he said, look, you had mentioned about the fact that you liked education as a space and you see a lot of future there. So we are just about launching this new product called Shiksha in the education space. And would you like to come and run that for us? That seemed like something that I could do. It was a business role. And I said, I jumped at it and I worked with him. And another thing in the, so then I think he wanted me to meet him and Hitesh once before I formally joined. And my past experience before getting into InfoEdge was with large companies. I'd worked with Airtel, which was not that big though at that point. And then before that, HUL, right? Where as a manager, you are really prided. You know, people look up to you if you know your facts, right? You are supposed to have answers to all the questions. So I went to this meeting with Sanjeev and Hitesh. And I asked Sanjeev and Hitesh that, look, you're asking me about the Shiksha. What do you think is the business potential, or how much do you think we should be doing in the next like 4-5 years or the next year? What are some of the goals, right? And Sanjeev looks at me and said, boss, we would want you to tell that to us. We don't know. We just think it's an opportunity here and we want to try this out. And to my mind, that was like a 180 degree flip on whatever I had considered sacrosanct in my career and life so far, which is that you needed to have a 5-year view. You needed to have like a, if somebody asked you, okay, what is the number that you will, what's the forecast for next 12 months? You should be able to come up with an answer. And you should have like an innovation pipeline that, you know, that, and I figured that, look, here when it's about new things, new opportunities, it's going to be far more ambiguous. It's much far more undefined. And it's about just discovering those pieces as you go along. And so that was very, very interesting for me.
That's really interesting. I think you're fortunate to have got to work with some of these leaders. So anyways, Prakash, thank you so much. I think this has been an enriching episode. I think just the learnings from obviously your early days at InfoEdge and Naukri and, you know, the rest of the brands, but also seeing Redbus, seeing all the good times over the last few years, and then how you've navigated this crisis and also being able to keep the team together. Honestly, it's been a lot of learning for everybody. So thank you so much. Personally, I've learned a lot through this conversation and I've loved the offline interactions as well. So thank you so much for taking out the time and, you know, look forward to doing more of these two with you in the future.
Thank you, Tarun. I enjoyed my time too. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in. For more Matrix Moments episodes, you can head to www.matrixpartners.in/blog. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for more updates.